Good morning again, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Lee Camp. I have the privilege of being here today representing the appellant in this matter, Ms. Latasha Johnson, who more importantly was the tenant in this case. We're here today to ask that this Court reverse the decision of the trial court below, which barred Ms. Johnson from access to Missouri courts to ensure that she and her disabled daughter had the opportunity to live in safe and habitable housing. In October 2014, Ms. Johnson entered into a lease with Koner Properties, the respondent. It was only 5 months later, in March, that she withheld her rent because of the conditions that had developed in this home. What started out as a shower tile falling off the wall early in her tenancy turned into an eventual water leak in the home, mold growth in the bathroom, and the eventual structural collapse of the ceiling above the shower in the only bathroom in the home. To spare the court details, we've enclosed copies of the exhibits from the trial court below as the appendix in the opening brief. When Ms. Johnson was sued in this case in March and it went to trial, she asserted an affirmative defense that her landlord had breached the implied warranty of habitability and also asserted a counterclaim against her landlord for the consequential expenses she had incurred during this time. The trial court's decision below to not allow Ms. Johnson to be heard on those claims has barred her right to access the courts. And we argue that that bar was incorrect for two reasons today. First, that as the Court of Appeals below found in this case, Ms. Johnson asserted an affirmative defense and a counterclaim consistent with this court's ruling in the case of Dabbling v. Edelbrock. Second, that the trial court's ruling imposing a procedural bar on Ms. Johnson's right to assert this action is actually contrary to the very policy purposes behind the implied warranty of habitability, and by being in contrast to those policy purposes, violates existing Missouri contract law, Missouri constitutional law, and the United States Constitution. In this case below, Ms. Johnson asserted a proper implied warranty of habitability defense and counterclaim. The first court in Missouri, the seminal court to recognize the implied warranty of habitability in residential rental leases, was the court in King versus Moorhead in the Western District. In 1973, that court told us that there is indeed an implied warranty that a landlord will provide a safe and habitable premises in every residential rental lease in Missouri. In that case, the court talked about how we were departing, this was a departure from the harsh remedies of property law, common property law. And the court looked to the initial abandonment of caveat emptor in constructive eviction. 11 years later, this court in Dabbling v. Edelbrock endorsed the implied warranty of habitability and indeed did find that this existed in every residential rental lease. And in doing so, the court articulated four elements that must be pled and proven to prevail on an implied warranty of habitability claim. Those elements are, first, a rental lease for residential property. Second, the subsequent development of dangerous and unsanitary conditions materially affecting the life, health, and safety of the family living in the home. Third, reasonable notice to the landlord that these conditions actually existed. And fourth, the subsequent failure of the landlord to restore the home to habitability. These are the elements that Ms. Johnson in this case pled and proved.
And in doing, as you know, opposing counsel says they also have to provide a bond and that that's not an element. Therefore, it didn't need to be listed in the elements. Can you address that argument made by opposing counsel?
Yes, Your Honor. The argument that there is a discussion that money must be set aside in any manner comes from the case of King versus Moorhead. Again, that was the 1973 seminal case that recognized the implied warranty of habitability. And in that case, the court tells us that a tenant's obligation to pay their rent is suspended when the landlord has breached the implied warranty of habitability. In that case, the court also suggests that a tenant who does withhold their rent shall post their rent into the court in custodia legis. That issue of posting your rent into the court, if you remained in possession of a home while there was pending litigation, was not actually before the court at that time. We argue that it is dicta, and we've outlined that argument in our brief as well. And we also argue that the Dettling elements are the controlling elements, and that this court in the Dettling case was determining exactly what must occur to plead and prove a successful implied warranty of habitability claim. The suggestion by the King court is simply dicta, but it is also As I explained, against the policy purposes of the implied warranty of habitability, which the King Court was very concerned with, but it's also against existing Missouri contract law. To ask that a party be able to, or ask that a party must pay their money into the court prior to being able to address a defense to a liability determination, here how much rent is actually owed, or to pay money into the court as a condition precedent to actually maintaining an action, would be a violation of the Missouri Constitution, but also the contract clause that Missouri recognizes, the first to breach clause, that a party's obligation to pay is suspended when one party has breached a contract.
So you're basically saying King and Detling said you treat it like a contract action, and if someone breaches, the other doesn't need to comply with the requirements of the contract, and we don't require a bond prior to suit in any other kind of contract action.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. In fact, it was the Detling court that told us that this remedy should be used like a contract remedy and could be used as a contract remedy. So, yes, exactly. There's no place like this in Missouri law. And to address the policy purposes behind this law and the dilemma that this escrow requirement would create for particularly low-income individuals is that they must make the choice to spend their limited fixed budgeted income, like Ms. Johnson did here, to try to move from the home, applying for other apartments, taking her disabled daughter to a hotel where she could take care of her on nights when the conditions were just that bad, or they must remain in the home, take the risk of defending this action or bringing an action against their landlord and post their money into the court. Neither of these situations incentivizes the landlord to actually make repairs to the property in a swift manner. This is an issue that the Court of Appeals particularly pointed out below, that a landlord could be armed with knowledge that a low-income tenant is stuck in this dilemma. And in fact, the trial court's decision here puts Ms. Johnson in that very dilemma. And the landlord would not be incentivized to actually fix the property if they, under the trial court's ruling, could just recover the property back, do a piecemeal fix, and then rent the property back to another family. We have an affordable housing crisis, not only in the state, but in this country, and we've outlined that for the court as well. This unit would be rented with minor repairs to it, and potentially a family could face the same problems and be left with no remedy to address these issues back against owner properties. I think there are also, it's important to address briefly the due process implications here that could face a tenant who would not be able to defend a lawsuit such as a low-income tenant here. While the Court of Appeals below suggested that there should be a potential discretionary hearing by the trial court, that discretionary hearing the Court of Appeals suggested does not actually outline any factors that would protect the tenant from having their due process imposed upon. And I think the most important of that is that a low-income tenant may not be able to use their fixed budget to comply with this order, which would again leave a tenant remedy-less to address the liability that their landlord claims they owe. They're shouldering a presumptive burden that they cannot overcome and cannot use the implied warranty of habitability to address, which was exactly why this court endorsed the implied warranty of habitability. And generally here, I think it's important to point out that the cleanest disposition of an implied warranty of habitability, affirmative defense or counterclaim or affirmative claim, comes by using existing contract law, exactly what this court had fashioned the test to be initially. If one party has breached under the rules of the first to breach rule that this court has recognized multiple times, this is a mere suspension of an obligation to pay. If the landlord was to fix the property within a month's time of this litigation pending, absolutely the tenant would be expected at that time to again resume paying their monthly rental portion back to the court. This is not an absolute that a tenant gets to remain in a home for free through the duration of their tenancy. If we use the first to breach rules, it comes to a clean disposition, and the courts are guided by existing case law, the Missouri Rules of Civil Procedure fashioned by this court, And it truly makes this an issue that does not get lost, as has happened here, where associate circuit courts below have followed dicta for years and have fashioned this as a requirement, even though it is not in the binding law. So today, we are asking that procedural bar that was imposed by this court be, or that this case be reversed, so that procedural bar is not imposed on Ms. Johnson, so that Ms. Johnson has the right to address the fact that she remained in a home that had a collapsed ceiling amongst the only bathroom in the home that would hardly be habitable for any of us in this courtroom today, that all she's asking for is the right to access the courts, to assert a defense to a lawsuit, but to also hold her landlord liable for failing to repair the property in that time. So in conclusion, I can see my time is coming up. We're asking that the court reverse the decision of the trial court below.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Randall Lanker. I really want to point out the timeline in this case. On March 17th, there's no doubt that the ceiling collapsed in the shower of this tenant's apartment. The last maintenance request by this tenant was February the 10th. She had a balance of rent in February. She started withholding rent on March the 1st. Therefore, she started withholding rent before this habitability question ever became about. And she shouldn't be allowed to take advantage of something that happens later in order to breach the agreement with my client. I'd also like to focus on the case of King versus Moorhead. And I agree with counsel, it's not something necessarily this court has to follow. However, the King court, like most courts, they struggle with the issues of balance. They struggle with issues of fairness, but they usually do it with common sense. And King saw that. And they said, look, we're going to carve out this new idea of implied warrant and habitability, but we think there ought to be some protections for the landlord, and we think that escrowing the rent money, which the tenant should already have, into the court provides that very balance. I think this court should adopt the reasoning from King. My next point
can
is...
Can you address why that's not dicta in King?
Oh, it is.
Okay.
But...
And this court did not repeat that or suggest that payment into a fund was required in Dentling. Can you tell us why we should follow dicta in a court of appeals opinion as opposed to the statement of the elements of the cause of action in the last case decided by this court?
Well, I agree that Dentling does set out the requirements for implied warrant and habitability. In that case, something that's different is the rent was being escrowed. So I don't know if the court in the Dentling case thought it was a non-issue, so they didn't address it. The Court of Appeals, the lower Court of Appeals in this case, really misses the point when looking at that implied warranty of habitability, because they miss the fact that there are two property interests at play here, not just the lease and the right to rental payments. My client has the right because it owns the property. It has a property interest in the property itself. The second interest it has, property interest, is the right to use that property to make money, which is the lease to get the money from the tenant. And the appellate court really just ignores the fact that they're going to allow the tenant to hold this property hostage and not pay the rent. She's getting two benefits of the property interest where my client is getting zero. So
Can you address the issue raised by opposing counsel that in other contract situations we don't require a bond in effect be paid prior to filing suit? For instance, if you delivered some property to me, so I bought a refrigerator and I said it wasn't what it was made out to be and I didn't want to pay you the full amount and we had a lawsuit over what I owed you, I don't have to put the amount that you say I owed you up in escrow until the suit is done. I get a sue and say I didn't get what I paid for. I want to keep the fridge, but it doesn't have value. Why is this different? You clearly think it is. Can you tell me why you think uniquely in this kind of contract situation where there's litigation over the value of something delivered in a contract that you need to pay up front here to sue, but not in other situations?
I think that's an excellent question. If I sell you a refrigerator and it's not a good refrigerator, you're not allowed to keep it. You have to give it back.
Before I can sue, you have to rescind the contract, or can I sue for damages And I may well owe you, but do I have to put money in escrow or return it before I can sue if I allege you breached the contract and not giving me what I contracted for?
Well, I would say to that that the property interest in real estate is a little different than an appliance.
And tell me why. That's my question.
Why is that different? It's because the
Because when it's treated as a breach of contract, which is what Detling says the breach of implied warranty of habitability is.
Well, our position is that it's different because it's land. It's not an appliance, and my client is being deprived of its due process rights because it can't take that land and do something else with it.
Is there a requirement in a sale of land, a breach of contract for a sale of land, to post a bond before proceeding in a lawsuit over that's real estate?
I'm not so sure about that. But I think when you post a bond, you're looking at protecting potential damages in the future. In this case, we're talking about my client's right for possessing the property and then the property right for the rent. And the rent is supposed to be paid to the landlord. A bond's a little different because it is to protect against something happening in the future. I also want, well, my point was is that I think in requiring the escrow rent late, it levels the playing field a little bit, because if the client, if the tenant's going to stay in the property, they shouldn't be able to also hold on to their rent. They ought to either get out or pay the money in escrow. That way, we started it as an even playing field. And I find it interesting that on
well, how is it an even playing field if their argument is that the property is not worth the value that you're saying the rent is, because it's in a defective condition, it's the ceiling's falling in, it's not habitable, therefore the rent is more than the property is worth? And they may be totally wrong, it may absolutely be worth what you say, but why do you have to have something put in escrow up front in case you happen to win?
Because that's for the court to determine, not for the tenant.
Right, absolutely. And until the court determines it, why do they have to pay what would be if you won up front? And tell me why uniquely in this situation, since we don't in any other one I know of require that.
In this particular situation?
In an implied warranty of habitability.
Because, well, in the appellate court's decision on page 17, they indicate, gee, landlord has all of its rights and remedies. They can go and sue for all the money that they're owed. However, in the reply brief of the defendants, they admit their client can't pay it. So there is no remedy for my client in this situation. They can't get the money because there's no way that Ms. Johnson's going to pay it. And I think everyone in this room is going to agree with me that if we're successful in this case, my client's not going to be able to collect the money from Ms. Johnson.
The trial court said that it would not allow the tenant to raise either as a counterclaim or an affirmative defense at this warranty of habitability. But then the trial court gave her a set-off for damages, consequential damages, due to the breach of the warranty of habitability. I have a little trouble reconciling those two. Do you have a
I agree with the judge. I don't think the judge should have allowed any sort of set-off. And there
but having allowed it, doesn't that undercut the earlier statement that he wasn't allowing the tenant to raise this issue when clearly he gave the tenant some relief under exactly the issue it previously said she couldn't raise?
True. Sometimes judges throw people a bone, and I disagree that should have never taken place. When we're talking about the elements of the implied warrant of habitability, I don't think anybody disputes there was a lease in this case. But the second point is you have to prove that it's a dangerous and unsanitary condition. There was no dangerous condition. In fact, I think I heard in the argument earlier today that it was so severe that for three nights she went and found a hotel. Well, I don't know that if your place is so severe that only three nights makes it uninhabitable. Additionally, there's no evidence in the record as to what she paid if she actually went to a hotel. So I don't think that there was a dangerous, unsanitary condition in this case. There was certainly a collapse of the ceiling in the shower. There was a leaky problem. But I think...
Weren't those issues for the trial court to resolve on those factual issues about the severity of the problem, how often she had complained, whether or not there was mold, whether or not it it impaired her daughter's ability to use the bathroom during the month period, and you both presented evidence on either side of that?
We did. And it's interesting because the cases that I've read, when it interprets the implied warrant of habitability, they talk about roaches and vermin and freezing and open wires and missing screens. And this case just doesn't rise to that level.
So you want us to hold as a matter of law that a hole in the ceiling where it fell through from the bathroom above and the mold, as a matter of law, is not a breach of the implied warranty of habitability?
No, we don't.
Okay.
We want the trial court to decide that. And clearly in this case, the trial court didn't think it was that severe a problem to provide a complete bar to my client's ability to collect the rent. And that's something else we should look at, is that the implied warranty of habitability is an affirmative defense. It is not a complete bar to claims, and they have to go and they have to prove it. Then they have to put on evidence. Okay, here's what I'm supposed to be paying in rent, and here's what I should get back because of what I've lost. There was no evidence of that. All there is I'm unhappy with my landlord, and I don't want to pay my rent. There was certainly, you mentioned the mold. There was no evidence of mold other than the bald assertion from the tenant. She has no training in mold, and there was no medical causation. There was any testimony like that that was elicited in this case to prove that there was any kind of a dangerous condition. There are hundreds of thousands of species and types of mold in this world. And you can't just come in and say, gee, I have mold, and therefore it's uninhabitable. The next item is, under the debt lien court, is that you have to give your landlord reasonable notice and give them time to fix the problem. I think the trial court transcript clearly shows that time after time after time after time, Kohner tried to fix this problem. They wrote her several letters saying, look, we need to get in there. And the tenants simply wouldn't cooperate. And I think that sort of ties into the item four as well, which is talks about under debt lien about the failure of the landlord. Well, landlord can't fix the problem if the tenant won't let them in. And even if in the trial court the tenant in this case had proved all of their elements of an implied warranty of habitability, she didn't offer any evidence of any damages. I have a closing thought, and my closing thought is economic based. Because we have a society, if we want to assure an adequate supply of affordable housing, if you increase the barriers to the investors, the managers, the builders, to entering into these apartment complexes to provide affordable housing, you're not going to increase the supply if you allow the tenants to hold those properties hostage and not pay their rent. They're going to put their money in the stock market or someplace else. And in fact, I think you're going to exacerbate the problem, if there is one, of a shortage of the supply of housing. There was a recent case that they had cited in their reply brief. It's out of Jefferson County, and then Judge Gertner, Gary Gertner, wrote the opinion. And the reason why I want to bring this up is that there's an argument on the other side that she has no ability to go anywhere to bring her case. She's closed out from the court system. And Judge Gertner writes, in fact, this court has noted that a separate trial for tenants' counterclaims may be preferable to trying them with the issue of possession. Given that the issue of possession can be disposed of quickly and summarily, while the others will require a considerable trial. I think that's really a lot of common sense. And I would like the court to follow the wisdom of King and this particular court.
Before you sit down, counsel, but did the tenant raise the constitutional arguments, access to courts and due process in the trial court?
Did not. There is one other item. The Matthews versus Eldridge case, and I'll just briefly touch on that, is that that is where we set out our due process violations. That's where we get the three-pronged test. And the most important one is the risk of erroneous deprivation. And in this case, you would allow, according to the appellate court, you would allow the tenant to make the decision whether or not there is an implied warranty of habitability claim. Secondly, you would then allow the tenant to withhold the rent based on what their perception is of habitability. And I just don't think that's fair, considering people aren't trained to determine what's mold, what's habitability. And then if the tenant is wrong, if the tenants are wrong on the grounds of the implied warrant of habitability, there's no way my clients can be able to recover from this. And since that's the case, then the risk of deprivation is extremely high to my client. Thank you. That's all I have.
Thank you.
Your Honors, I'd like to address three different points that were brought up in that argument. First, the issue of the timeline and the facts of this case. I think, as you pointed out, Judge Stith, the factual determination absolutely should be made at the trial court. And the issue here is not that the trial court didn't make factual determinations on the evidence, but the trial court did not make those factual findings in consideration of the purview of the implied warranty of habitability. What this court told us is an affirmative defense and a counterclaim in a contract setting. There was a $300 set-off for a breach of the maintenance clause. However, what we're here asking today is that that the evidence be considered in light of the implied warranty of habitability, and that did not happen here. The second point, I think, is probably the most important here is the argument that the King Court was attempting to balance the interests of both parties, and as has been stated by both of us, we agree there are competing property interests in this case. However, under the Dettling instruction that the implied warranty of habitability is an affirmative defense and a counterclaim, by requiring that a party make an additional step of escrowing money to the court or bonding money into the court, we're creating a special class of litigants for landlords that does not exist in other areas in contract law. The argument that you would not be able to collect on a judgment, that turns common law from the Magna Carta on its head. Under this ruling, we're essentially asking that the breached party, the injured party, subsidize the contract performance of the breaching party. And again, from a pragmatic standpoint, this has never been analyzed by any court, how this procedurally would work in practice in a very fast-moving docket where cases rocket through in a month like this case did.
These are statutory causes of action and intended to be relatively quick.
Yes, Your Honor.
For both parties' benefit. If the legislature had put in the requirement for escrowing the rent, would you doubt that would be effective?
I think if the legislator was to put in a requirement that absolutely barred a litigant from having that ability to answer and address whether they actually owed rent liability, then that would be unconstitutional. I think there is an area where if there was a discretionary hearing that had certain procedural protections, we've outlined many for this court from other jurisdictions that we can find. I think that possibly in that situation, the pretrial procedure could work within the due process of the law, but an absolute bar or a tenant's inability to conform to a trial court's order, if it prevented the tenant from being able to go to court and address the issue of whether or not they actually owed money, whether they were liable for damages to their landlord, that would be a due process violation, and the Supreme Court has held that multiple times.
And did you raise the constitutional claims in the trial court?
It's interesting, Your Honor. We didn't raise these in any of our pleadings. And the reason why is the procedural posture behind this case. The first time that we were presented with an objection to using the defense or the claim of the breach of the implied warranty of habitability was in an oral motion before the court minutes before this case went to trial. Judge Draper in this case took it under submission, that pretrial motion, and allowed us, both parties, to present their evidence. It was not until after the trial court's disposition where we found out that we were actually barred from, where Ms. Johnson finds out that she was barred from the service.
So you're saying your answer raised this as an affirmative defense?
Our answer raises as an affirmative defense.
And there was no response of pleading, so you didn't know till the hearing?
That's right, Your Honor. Okay. We did not, and we in fact did not know that the evidence was not being considered in the light of the implied warranty of habitability until the trial court's order and judgment came down in this case.
Did you raise it in the motion for new trial?
We did not in this case, Your Honor. We took a direct appeal.
Were you required to file a motion for new trial?
We were not, Your Honor. Not that I'm aware of. And there has, procedurally at this time in the Associate Circuit Courts with landlord-tenant cases, there has been a gray area because of the legislators repealing the trial de novo for a tenant. In the past, even 5 years ago, if we were to have lost this case on these grounds, we would have filed a trial de novo and appealed directly off of that trial de novo. But with the abrogation of that right, it was a little gray at this time, and things have kind of played out in practice. So, again, in conclusion, we're asking that this court reverse the decision of the trial court, barring Ms. Johnson's access to the courts.
Thank you. Case will be submitted.